events of 1989, the collapse of Stalinism, was the last great global event politically as regards mass revolutionary movements, if you like. But it also resulted in exactly the opposite of what we would have liked, and certainly what the majority of people in Berlin, East Berlin, and majority of people in East Germany, and indeed most of the majority of people in Eastern Europe at the time wanted. So it's very peculiar circumstances that a series of events, a chain of events unleashed that resulted in the opposite result to what the majority of people wanted. Having said that, the reality of changing people's living standards in Germany, in particular, let's take Germany for a starting point, is real. You know, people have had, you cannot turn around and say when you look at Berlin that there's been a collapse in living standards for the majority of the population. That would not be true. There has been a catastrophic transformation in the way that people live, and a transformation in particular in the structure, class structure of power and the human relations between people. But Berlin, East Germany, did not experience a complete collapse in living standards, in real living standards. That would be false to state. So, to give you a rough overview, if you look around Berlin, I'm sure some of you have time to do so, or East Germany, you'll see there has been a tremendous investment by the capitalists since 1989 up until the mid-1990s, end of the 1990s, which resulted in significant development of buildings, repair of buildings, infrastructural development. You know, they've blown in. I remember one engineer from Germany, he turned around to me, senior engineer in a major factory, and he said, when they threw in the money, they blew life into significant sections of the economy. Having said that, they were unable to incorporate East Germany, even in Germany, one of the richest countries of the world, I think it was at the time third richest country of the world, I think it was, in 1989, was unable to fully incorporate East Germany within the economic and political and cultural and welfare system of its own state, if you like. To this day, they failed to do that adequately, such that there is a significant difference politically, culturally and economically and psychologically, perhaps most importantly of all, between East and West of Germany. This reflects itself also even in Berlin, even in one street and another street. We are like literally 300 metres from the wall here, and between one side of the city and the next side of the city, there is still this differentiation between the people, between East and West. It's not as marked as it used to be. A lot of people will deny it's there. But other people, when you confront them about the real circumstances, it may be a little thing. Like there's a guy who runs a cafe at Checkpoint Charlie. He's an Easterner. He actually went to the West in 1988. Him and his wife, they're very much pro-capitalist. They run a little business. They're very much pro-capitalist. But I said to him, when some people who came on one of my tours came along, they asked, what's the difference? You know, is there any difference now? He said, well, his daughter goes to ballet classes in West Berlin and they all ignore her because she's a stupid Easterner, like that. So there is a psychological conflict between the people as well, coming from different background with a different historical tradition and a different way of relating to each other and relating to work. Interesting in particular because it's like in this city, it is a... what can you say? A test tube experiment in the differences between human beings created by social systems. Because here we have literally in one street, one people, another street, another people, under two different social systems. So you can, from that, you can probably analyse and assess much about the nature of man, if you like. In parts of East Berlin, which, let's say, around central East Berlin, there are some districts where in the elections, the left party, the former Communist Party, will receive 65 or 70% of the vote. They generally will be some of the people you will see tomorrow, that is the old grey heads, but also the old doctors and professors and Communist Party members or Socialist Unity Party members of the past, but it's also affected a younger layer of the population. A lot of young people consider themselves Eastern by identity, and we had two of these comrades from something called the Brigadas Internacionales, like a group, youth group that sends people to Venezuela. They came to London a little while ago, and then we had a meeting in London a couple of weeks ago of some left youth in left German youth in London. And the two from East Berlin both said, "Oh, we are Easterners. We don't even visit West Berlin." And this is 20 years after the war. A friend of mine who runs a newspaper here, a left-wing newspaper here, he said to me, I was sitting at the Mauer Park, it's like a park next to the wall, and he said to me, he was 17 at the time, I met him in 1989, and he said to me, I said, "Do you know anybody from West Berlin?" He's a very open person, and he doesn't know anybody from West Berlin. He knows a few foreigners and so on, and then otherwise they've got a group of East Berliners involved in like a left-wing organization, the Solid Group, and they run their own newspaper, Rot Dorn, it's called Red Thorn, it's called. And so there is this difference of identity, different background, if you like. One of the aspects of 1989 is the way in which people felt betrayed by politics, in particular betrayed by bourgeois democratic politics. From 1989 onwards, this has increased. There have been consistent surveys carried out by the West German government, the official surveys of the government, which have consistently stated that the majority of population, in fact, high percentages, 70 to 80% of the population of East Germany, believe that socialism is a good system that was not carried out in practice, which of course is our position. This figure even rose in West Germany to the point of reaching over 50% of the last survey that they carried out on this question. So there is a fundamental cultural orientation towards socialism as a result of the whole wave of different political crises and social crises in the last century in Germany. To come to 1989 was started off by the crisis, or if you like, the first wave of revolts took place in China in 1989. In 1989, there was the Tiananmen Square movement, the occupation of the square. There were protests and demonstrations in every major city of China, but it was a protest led by the youth, and which drew behind it the urban population in protest about wage conditions for the workers, about corruption, about misuse of power, and but not against the party itself in China. There was no significant protest against the Communist Party in 1989 in China. The consequence of that was, some of you might have been on the tour yesterday, I mentioned this, was that when the regime in China sent the army in, the first time the army joined with the protesters, the second time the army basically crushed the protest movement. I remember discussing with Alan at the time, and he said, "Look at the mess the students have made on the square. If the workers were involved in organising this, they wouldn't make such a mess." Because there was a time on Tiananmen Square where they were camping on the square for around a month and a half, and the students organised food to feed themselves and so on. It was very hot weather, and there was a danger that would be disease spreading because they were just chucking the rubbish all over the place. And Alan said, "Well, if the workers get involved and organise that, then they'll clear up the mess." And to some degree, that did happen. Right at the end of the protest movement in 1989 in China, workers got involved in it. But otherwise, the workers were generally not involved. The students rejected the support of the workers in the critical last week of the protest movement in 1989. They told the workers, "We don't need your support." I went and discussed with some... I went to Tiananmen Square then, and a few nights before the crackdown, I went and discussed with a student from Nanjing, and he said, "Well, the leaders of the student movement have anchored themselves in position and refused to give up that position. We need to call new elections for the leadership of the Tiananmen Square protest, because the people who are leading the movement at the moment are not representative of our opinions." But of course, this was a difficult thing. You have to, every university in China, if you like, reflected in the square, had to call for a re-election of those representatives. And the television around the world and the radio around the world had focused on those people and selected them to be the candidates, if you like, to be the representatives of the Chinese protest movement. And even to this day, they will be selected as people who represent that. Chai Ling in particular, quite a reactionary individual. She became known as the female voice of Tiananmen Square, if you like. Once the Chinese government crushed the movement, there was a period when the population were temporarily stunned. There was huge support in Beijing for the protest movement, but the population was stunned, and then they gradually came to accept the logic of the government. And if you ask now the population, there's a lot of talk about this in the newspapers, so it's the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, everyone in China is going to be thinking about. In fact, very few people are concerned about that now, because living standards rose, conditions improved. It's a forgotten story for most of the population in China, the Tiananmen Square events. However, there's combined and uneven development, isn't there? The combined development meant that in Eastern Europe, where there had been reform taking place in Russia, which allowed, to some degree, a freeing up of prices. Now, let's get to the crux of what the problems here are. You had a bureaucracy, a Stalinist bureaucracy, pyramidically controlling the entire apparatus of the economy in the Soviet Union. In East Germany, you had 200 combines controlled the entire economy of East Germany. Everything was controlled by the state, almost without exception. I remember going in Leipzig to one bar, and my friend said, "This is a good bar, because it's a private bar." And it was the only private bar in the whole of that district of Leipzig which you could go to. Everything from the local corner shop to the people who collect, you know, who you could take your bottles to the local hot dog stand, they were all owned by the state. Now, there are consequences from that. If they're all owned by the state, then the population, a lot of them feel the quality is missing. There's no concern for, you know, how good a cup of tea you're going to get, or how good a hot dog you're going to get, or how good the chips are, or how good the bread is in the shop. Actually, the bread was good, but the hot dog's not so good. So people were confronted with this problem. They wanted to know how they could transform the economy without re-establishing capitalism, having a counter-revolution. And this was the general attitude. This was even the attitude of many of the leadership in the Soviet Union. It was also the attitude of many people over here. We'll come to East Germany in a little while, because the Soviet Union was pretty much the background to this process in East Germany. I was speaking to, there's a comrade from Ethiopia here by the name of Hailu. I was speaking to him this morning. If you get a chance to talk to him, talk to him. He was in the Soviet Union 1987 to 1992, and he was studying at a military academy, learning to be a senior officer in the defense forces for Ethiopia, and they had 19 different countries represented in this training school, military training school at the time. And he described how at the time of the introduction of perestroika, suddenly the ruble was worthless. You had, instead of 30 rubles exchanged for $1, you suddenly had, 20 rubles, then 30 rubles, then 300 rubles. The currency became useless and worthless. He said in the shops, you went to the shops and the shops would be empty, but as soon as you walked down the street, someone would turn around to you and say, "We want to buy," and they would offer you to sell you something. It could be anything. He said you could get anything you wanted, as long as you paid them with some sort of, either with hard currency or at extortionate rates of exchange. This is one of the natures of the Stalinist system, was that they were enclosed autarkic economies. The consequence of that was that, for example, in Berlin, we discussed, some of us went round yesterday to look at the Berlin Wall. This was also a product of the difference between an economy where you have an entirely autarkic economy, publicly owned, where the products is only for the internal market. And in West Berlin, you had access to goods from all around the world. And so, of course, once the Berlin Wall was open, I'll come back to that a little bit later on, then all the goods in the world that were available in West Berlin were visible to the population, whereas in East Berlin, you couldn't get hold of those goods. You only had a limited supply of goods connected directly with the East German marketplace. So this is very important, understanding why psychologically people behave the way they behaved after the opening of the war. Well, I'll come back to that in a little while. I'll deal with the revolution. Politically, there were a number of events which led to the specifics of the revolution. One was the opening of the Hungarian border, which led to people who wanted to leave East Germany, being able to leave East Germany. This could only have happened in the way it happened because East Germany didn't allow people to travel, which is obviously a complete negation of any socialist idea. The idea that you enclose people and refuse to allow them to leave your country has nothing to do with socialism, obviously. However, there was a certain logic behind having a border which controlled the inflow and outflow of currency. There was a logic to that. Because without that, I remember being on a demonstration here must have been the 5th of November, or a couple of days before that. And it was a discussion. And someone got up and he said, there were many, many speakers, and one person got up and he said, there were about 10,000 people in the audience, and he said, we should remove the Berlin Wall. And a couple of people clapped. And everyone was like uncomfortable like that. And then he sensed that no one was interested in that. And then he said, no, we should put a fence there instead and control, you know, the currency, the flow of currency. Because if you could walk from one side of the city to the other with a currency with an exchange rate of 12 to 1 between West Berlin and East Berlin, you were going to have a catastrophic breakdown in the economy as soon as that border was open. And that effectively is what happened later on, but I'll come to that in a little while. So there was the Hungarian opening of the border, and then there was an election in June. Any Polish comrades here? No, there was an election in June in Poland, which allowed Solidarity. Solidarity won a majority in that election. But it didn't change the state. At the time, I remember we discussed this question, and the state apparatus, the army and police, were still in the hands of the Stalinists. And therefore, we thought, well, they'll still be able to control the situation. Actually, it was ignoring the amount of weight that was anti-Stalinist within Poland. But again, there was the secondary question, is how will the Soviet Union respond in the event of changes in these countries? Will there be a coup d'etat in the Soviet Union which would reimpose control over all these countries? That was the basic perspective we had at the time, was that eventually, even if all these countries had revolts, the Soviet Union, there would be a removal of Gorbachev and the installation of a new dictatorship which would re-establish authority. The East German events basically came to a head in the summer of 1989 over the question of the right to leave the country. People gathered in the embassy in Prague, they tried to escape through Hungary. Eventually, even the border to Czechoslovakia was closed off. And people said, now we're completely enclosed. That was one layer of the population. The other layer of the population said, now we must protest and demand a change. And you could sense it in the air. Everywhere you went, you would talk to people on the streets or in the cafes and the bars, and people were saying, they said, no, what's going on? And people would always sit together. They would sit, knock on the table, sit down. You always sat together with other people. You never went and sat on your own, otherwise they'd think you're a nutcase. It was a culture in East Germany that everybody sort of collectively gathered in a bar or a cafe. And they would all discuss sort of with whispers and discussing and looking around a little bit, feeling a bit uncomfortable in case there were supposedly police agents watching over them. And that was so widespread that you knew something was about to blow up, that the whole mood was going to explode. On the 7th of October, when Gorbachev came for the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of East Germany, there were a number of people in my own circle who said, tonight's the night's going to go up. And I thought they're messing around. There was a whistle-blowing protest of around 100 people on Alexanderplatz. That protest had taken place for about a year, about some rigged elections the year before. And it normally attracted only a few dissidents. This time, a lot of young people went and stood on the corners by the sides. They knew the secret police would be all around and so on. They stood on the corner by the side, and then about 40, 50 of these people went blowing their whistles. And then they started chanting, and then people started gathering and joining them. They moved from about 50 to 100 to around 3,000-4,000, and then moved up towards Prenzlauer Berg. First they went towards the radio station, saying they should tell the truth. again, this question about a lack of freedom of expression, a lack of mechanisms for free expression, free press, free press, free media, free outlets of expression. This was the focal point of the initial phase of the revolution. It wasn't economic in East Germany. It was primarily political that was the focal point of the revolution. Once they began to protest, of course, then the protests expanded out across the whole country. There were demonstrations in every village and town of East Germany, demonstrations which would march. The method they used was called the Monday demonstration. People would gather together at a single point, then they would march around the town, then they would have an assembly at the end where anyone could get up and speak. But of course, when you say it's democratic, anyone can get up and speak, it does mean that certain groups, certain people are more likely to be up there first. The people who were up there first were the people who founded the organisations of opposition in East Germany. One group called New Forum, which requested partly from within the party, partly from within the churches, partly from the dissident movement, partly from secret police agents. These people, literally it was like that, and these people combined together and put forward a very, very simple program of allowing discussion, more freedom of expression. The party needs to incorporate different opinions. We need to discuss about the nature of our society and to change it internally. That was the idea. So a loyal opposition they wanted to be. But the East German Stalinists were very much in the mode. These were people who had been, well, Honecker had been in prison 10 years under the Nazis. They were people who had been trained under Stalin's time, and they had that mentality still in their head. Everything had to be controlled, and controlled in the way, the old mode, if you like. Not Gorbachev's way, but the old mode. So you have on the one side, the Stalinists in East Germany, if you like, aligning themselves with China, with the repression in China, with the idea that they were going to use force to control the situation. And on the other side, you had the majority of the population, particularly the youth, orientating towards the idea of democratization, processes like in the Soviet Union, freedom of expression, and these two forces, if you like, were going to clash. But within these forces, then there was also a series of other forces, which probably we vastly underestimated at the time. Someone said to me, about a month or two before the revolution really came to a head, I said, what do you think the situation is? He says, it's on a knife edge. And he probably had a much better analysis than me. He said, on a knife edge. I said, what do you mean? He says, counter-revolution. So on a knife edge, could it be counter-revolution or revolution? And the truth was, it was both. What happened then was, when the protest movement took on force, then the demands that people raised initially were entirely within the realms of the program of political revolution. Political revolution meaning that you have a planned economy run by a bureaucracy which is overthrown by the working class, demanding a democratization of the management and control of that society and the diminishing of the state within the population. One example of that was on the demonstration on the 4th of November, which was a giant demonstration, the peak of the revolution. Someone came marching past, they had a banner that said, everybody in the Stasi. Everybody should be the Stasi itself should disappear, and then Stasi in der Produktion, which was a revolutionary slogan, no doubt about it. It's the slogan and program of Leon Trotsky. Stasi in der Produktion means the secret police should put on the production line. And this was, again, the normal demand of all the major demonstrations. Right across the whole country, this was ringing in the ears of the masses. So, of course, it was natural to believe, well, this is the political revolution, and this is how it represented. And when you spoke to people and said the program of political revolution, 70% of the people, I would say, in my opinion, 70% of the people would agree with you. There began to be the emergence of a discussion about capitalism after the Berlin Wall was opened. Before that, nobody discussed capitalism. Literally nobody. This may have been because people believed, as most people did, that the Berlin Wall was a permanent feature, that the East-West system was a permanent feature, that Stalinism in the Soviet Union would never allow East Germany to turn capitalist or a unification of Germany, that the Western powers would never allow Germany to reunite, and therefore, you know, the idea that you could have capitalism or reunification of Germany simply was not in people's minds. The West German Social Democrats, as far as I remember, you'd be able to say that much better than me, I believe they had a position pretty much that this was an impossibility, and they couldn't raise this question either. The Social Democrats in East Germany, when they were founded, there were a whole series of parties founded by small groups. 10 people would get together. I remember in Dresden, there was something called the Committee of 10. And this was, you know, the get together, 10 people get together, write a proposal, put it forward, and that was, you know, then they formed a movement. And then thousands of people would come on a demo and they would speak to them. We are the Committee of 10 and this is our program. After the first demonstrations, so October, November, you had all these groups mushrooming out of nowhere. Groups, the Committee of 10, the Nelken, I remember there was a Marxist, the Nelken, the Marxist Party. You had dozens of little groups formed, each of which would attract quite large numbers of people to their meetings. Unfortunately, we didn't have a base. We couldn't call such a group. We probably should have. That if we would have had a base, we probably could have called something early. Summer 1989, formed a small group, declared its program, presented it to the public, and we would have had thousands and thousands of people following, at least initially, following what we were saying. I don't think there's any doubt about that whatsoever. But we didn't have that base. We didn't have the group. We didn't have the people. We had a few people, handfuls of people here or there, and that was it. So it's as much a lost opportunity as anything else. In many ways, it was a lost opportunity. And then comes the question of the Communist Party. Given that the masses are demanding a transformation of society and that they're demanding the overthrow of a Stalinist bureaucracy, and that the Stalinist bureaucracy has a secret police apparatus controlling or monitoring the society, it would be better to say than just controlling, it's an exaggeration, just everything's controlled by the Stasi is an exaggeration as well. How do you relate to that? How do you relate to that party? Well, the masses, of course, were taken to the streets and saying, you know, the party was corrupt, the party was run by criminals, and they were stealing wealth and so on, there was a layer of that within East Germany, but it wasn't the dominant process within the East German party. It did exist, but it wasn't the dominant. How did we relate to that? I remember one comrade was in the Socialist Unity Party, and because the mood had turned so severely anti the leadership, but that meant that there began to be a sense we're against the party itself. She went in December, I think it was the 12th of December, she went outside the Staatsratsgebäude, I think it was, the State Council building, and there was a protest of Communist Party members, 50,000 Communist Party members went and protested, and then foolishly, of course, she stood there with the others and tore up her party card and threw it away. And this was, if you like, a natural process, but one that was probably wrong. And we probably should have oriented, my personal opinion, we should have orientated at that time. It seems logical now that we work in the left party. We should have orientated at that time to the Communist Party. We had a discussion inside the organisation. Processes were moving very, very fast. We had discussions inside the organisation. How should we relate to what party? In fact, some comrades wanted to work with the Social Democrats. Some comrades wanted to work in the general movement. Some comrades said work in New Forum. New Forum originally had 80% of the support of the population. Within a few months, it had gone down to, I believe, 14%, wasn't it, in the actual elections? I think 10 or 14%. Very small amount in any case. So this was the phase of revolution and confusion, but mass movements. Then you had December to January 1989, where the movement changed character. It was still the same demonstrations around the towns, slightly lower numbers. I remember going in Leipzig on a demonstration, and in Leipzig there was people would gather at the main square, Karl Marx Platz. There would be about 100,000 people, perhaps 120,000. At the peak, the demonstrations in Leipzig were about 300,000 out of a population of 500,000. So you have an idea, every Monday. Yeah? We went down to about 100,000, sometimes in the very cold weather, maybe 50,000 people on the square. People would get up and speak. Whatever was said on the platform would then be repeated the next day in the newspapers, pretty much word for word. And if it was possible for the party to change, or the apparatus, the bureaucracy, to introduce the reforms demanded, they would do it immediately. So this was a state where the demands of the masses were being implemented immediately that they were raised. An example of that, on a student demonstration on the 14th of November 1989, that's 10 days after the Berlin Wall was opened, we were quite heavily involved, and I was involved in Humboldt University. We created a student council at the university, which went through, first it was opposed by the apparatus. All the students who were involved in it were told, if you go ahead with this, you're going to be expelled from the university, you're not going to get any job, you're going to, you know, come up. Some of them came back crying, I remember, from a meeting with the apparatus of the university. A few days later, we called a meeting, 4,000 students turned up, and they granted a permit for publishing a newspaper and for a student council, every single class, elected, recallable at any time, to run the university, for the section of the university that the students would be able to run. So contagious was the mood that that night when we set up the student council, there was a young man from the military academy who came and visited us that night. We discussed with him. The same night he went back to the military academy. The next day they formed a military council inside his army education. It was a school, army school. So that was how contagious and how explosive the mood was, if you like. Once the Berlin Wall was opened, the mood began to change. People went to West Berlin, they saw West Berlin. Everybody in East Germany, pretty much within 3 weeks, had been to West Berlin or to West Germany once. The revolution pretty much declined for a little while. Sorry, I was going to talk about 14th of November. On the 14th of November, at a demonstration on Platz der Republik, there was a Chinese student there. That's the reason I was going to mention it. And I knew the guy, and I said to him, look, the East German government have voted in favour of supporting the massacre on Tiananmen Square unanimously. You should mention this, because the consideration was they are still prepared to use violence to crush the revolution. So he got up and said this. The next day, newspaper, Neues Deutschland, Berliner Zeitung, perhaps we should reassess our viewpoint about Tiananmen Square. And then they took a vote and changed their position, that they disagreed with the Tiananmen Square massacre and they had to question it and so on and so forth. So that was how powerful the mass movement was, that every idea that was raised in the movement immediately became nationally discussed within the apparatus and within the apparatus of communication. This is one side, the internal process in East Germany. The other side to it is the East Germans had access to West German television right from the origin of television. They had access to West German radio, right from the origin of radio. RIAS, radio in American sector, would broadcast into East Germany right throughout the period of the existence of East Germany. So East Germany was a very peculiar state, because here you had a state which was Stalinist, where they controlled the mass media inside East Germany, but everybody could watch West German television and listen to West German radio. And so they were influenced by this, and we ignored the influence of this to some degree, I think. We underestimated what that influence was and how that was affecting the movement as well. So when people saw West Germany, a lot of people said, well, why can't we live like that? Why can't we have the same? They've got a social welfare system. And then there was the question, well, will all the refugees go to West Germany? If, you know, there was one slogan that someone invented in Leipzig. If the Westmark doesn't come to us, we will go to the Westmark. And that was, people would leave en masse, the economy of East Germany would collapse, there would be millions of refugees in West Germany. And so in these circumstances, Chancellor Kohl was a very astute politician in some ways. He played his card. He played the card of counter-revolution as well as he could. What did that mean? He proposed something that was unheard of, that a German chancellor would not obey what the authorities internationally are telling them. In other words, the British, the French, the Americans and the Russians, who actually, in theory, had ultimate control rights over Germany since the Second World War. He said, we will have a united Germany. And this was the first time this was really raised. In December 1989, he went to Dresden, and he spoke there, and people were chanting, Helmut, Helmut, Helmut. And this was a shock for people. No one really knew this. This was latent within the mood, that people would say, you could have a united Germany, that this transformation was possible. And it was under these circumstances that the counter-revolution suddenly took on wings and took on power. And the consequence of was that the anti-communist party mood turned into a counter-revolutionary mood. that the slogans which previously sounded okay actually became slogans of counter-revolution. And so within a revolution, you have different forces at play, and it's interesting to investigate and analyse how those forces played themselves out. And it would be even worthwhile doing, you know, the American army, they do like controlled experiments. They play war games where they plan out this sort of the scenario. What if the Venezuelan government is overthrown, and what will the response be from this country or that country? It's worthwhile sometimes perhaps in your organisation discussing, by analysing what happened in a country, discussing what the scenarios are and how we as revolutionaries should respond to those scenarios. Because this is a living, if you like, Alan was at a meeting, an art of tactical intervention. And this is a very difficult phenomenon to deal with. A real test of a revolution, of a real test of a revolutionary organisation and of a revolutionary individual is a revolution. In the revolution itself, you see all these processes take place very rapidly, very suddenly, and you have to intervene immediately, and you make mistakes. If you keep making those mistakes, you end up on the wrong, you know, even in the wrong camp of a revolution. So in March 1989, they called for an election. In January 1990, called for an election. March 1990, the counter-revolution won the election. The Christian Democrats, in coalition with the Social Democrats, had a program of counter-revolution. At the time, I remember, we prepared an article for the front page of our newspaper which said, don't vote for the bureaucrats. And left party, pack your things, go away. That's right. And then we had another one, don't vote for your bureaucrats. That was my attempt to bridge the gap. Don't vote for the bureaucrats, don't vote for the old bloc parties, which included the new Western parties. Consequently, and one comrade turned around and said, Christiane, I don't know if you remember, she turned around and she said, no, we can't put this, she said, we have to put vote left, which actually was right. You think back, it was actually right. It was the correct slogan to have. But, you know, this was a very fast-moving situation where we were dealing with one movement, but also which had many different tendencies and movements within it. In relation to the international processes, I'll just quickly come to a close on that. The East German Revolution, as far as we were concerned, had to be the start of the pan-European or East European Revolution, then perhaps the West European Revolution. The problem was we had Berlin. If East Germany would have been its own country and recognised as such and remained as such and had two different passports in two different countries, and you had to have, you know, go to West Germany, you didn't get paid by the West German government, you didn't get accepted as a citizen of West Germany. It's possible that East Germany would have had a political revolution in those circumstances. I think that really is a genuine possibility. But this wasn't the case. East Germany was a divided country as a consequence of the Second World War. And this peculiarity led to this odd, distorted counter-revolution, which took an entirely democratic form. There's no dispute about that. However, in Czechoslovakia, you had a different process. In Czechoslovakia, you had a revolution from the 14th of November, so a few days after the East German events, 4th of November, then the 9th of November, the opening of the Berlin Wall. A couple of days after that, a revolution in Czechoslovakia. What was the revolution? Again, mass protests on the streets, so many people that the state could do nothing. Couple of clashes and that was it. The state had to collapse. Václav Havel was the dissident, along with a few other dissidents. They became the leadership of the opposition movement. The problem in Czechoslovakia was, Czechoslovakia considered itself an oppressed nation in the sense that the Russian army was there stopping them doing what they wanted. And so this combined together with the mass movement enabled them to turn that towards a counter-revolution, through saying, we want to join up with Western Europe and become part of this whole, you know, game. And they ended up in the splitting of Czechoslovakia and the restoration of capitalism there. In Hungary, there were less protests, but there were big protests in Hungary, but it wasn't quite as big. Hungary had carried out a series of market-orientated reforms sometime before, not as sharply as China or as sharply as Yugoslavia, but they did have that. The Hungarian Communist Party, however, had had this long legacy of being disliked as a consequence of 1956, perhaps more so than the other countries, because there was quite a barbaric massacre in 1956. I think that that's one of the reasons why the Hungarian, if you like, collapsed without any sort of struggle at all, it appeared. I don't know if there's a Hungarian commissar here to contradict that or not, but that's roughly my just impressionistic view. But then there was the final end of the year, 1989, again linked together with what happened in East Germany, Czechoslovakia and the other countries, which was the culmination on Christmas Day of the killing of Ceausescu. Mass demonstration called by Ceausescu himself. Within half an hour, it turns against him. Some people chanted a couple of things against, whistled, and you might have seen the pictures. It's if you like, the summary of 1989, the essence of 89 was that. Ceausescu standing on the platform, waving at half a million people who he'd gathered himself, and then they start whistling, and then you see this fear in his eyes, and the cameraman shaking, and the whole mood changing suddenly, and within a few minutes, the building storm, Ceausescu flying away on a helicopter, and then he's captured and killed by a revolutionary council as well, it was, a revolutionary council who took arms, National Salvation, who took up arms, and they wandered around. Alan, you ask Alan, he went there, I believe, at the time. They wandered around, guns in hand, in the factories. They had committees, councils, and a militia, if you like, which controlled the country for a period of time. Romania was a backward country, and under the pressure of the other events in the other countries, Romania ended up following the same path towards capitalism as the other countries. The consequence of 1989 was a series of wars in Yugoslavia. The coup d'etat happened in Russia in 1991. Gorbachev was removed from power, then was restored to power temporarily. Then Yeltsin split up the Soviet Union, and this whole process, which began in Berlin actually, or rather in Europe began in Berlin, resulted in a wave of counter-revolutions across the whole of Eastern Europe. How exactly these happened, what processes happened, how the capitalists restored power, how the Communist Party reacted, is a field in which all the communists have a responsibility, because no one else is going to do it, to study these processes and analyse what happened. It is as significant to understand the processes of counter-revolution as it is to understand the process of revolution. In fact, it's necessary to understand the process of counter-revolution as it is to understand revolution. So I'll open the floor and let all the communists throw in, if you like, what knowledge they have about the subject and ideas they have about these subjects as well. Hans Gerd and Maria Clara and others who were there at the time as well can explain to you how these processes developed as well. Thanks very much.